This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero or the Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Welcome to episode 61 of Art, Not Science. My name is Jane Wallace, and I'm the curator at the Physics Room. In this episode, we share a poem and an interview from our curriculum session, hosted with Samoa House Library in the context of our recent exhibition, Distance is a Blade, curated by Amy Wing. Curriculum is Samoa House Library's education program, developed with the intention of providing a horizontal structure in which artists, writers, and community can share knowledge and resources on a peer-to-peer basis. Tonight, you'll be listening to Honey Brown read Marcy Calabretta Canciobello's poem, In the Animal Garden of My Body. This poem, and particularly its final line, was a point of reference for the title, of Distance is a Blade. Canciobello writes of this poem that, I have spent a lifetime studying forgiveness, and I am constantly humbled by how complicated, impossible, and necessary it is to every memory. Such themes of memory, forgiveness, and intimacy were also central to the exhibition, which, through the work of Akil Ahmad, Yu Moi Zeng, and Olivia Hong, contended with effective forms of myth-making that carry us into the future. In the Animal Garden of My Body by Marcy Calabretto Canciobello has been sourced from the Academy of American Poets website, poets.org, and was published in 2018.
Ask me again how the story should go. How much the underbelly of my garden held to bring forth spring. How much hunger I had to devour to get the sweetness I wanted from it. Did this devouring frighten you? I frightened myself in how much I promised to tell you if you asked me again about the water, the water, the water. What errors I made, calculating the downward trajectory of memory rattling loose in the inhale. Sharpen the shoulder blades, exhaling like wings, or whales, or swizzles of light. Ask me again what I offered as a sacrifice to the rooster crowing his betrayal of morning. Forgiveness, what a sharp blade I press my body hard against.
That was Honey Brown reading In the Animal Garden of My Body by Marcy Calabretto Canciobello, originally published on the Academy of American Poets website, poets.org, in 2018.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Next up, you'll hear myself, Jane, and Honey, reading an interview by Hans de Meyer with the late scholar and cultural theorist Lauren Boulant, Lauren Boulant on Intimacy as Worldmaking, published in Extra Extra magazine number 16 in May 2021. Boulant's work challenges heteronormative ideas of a good life and asks what other forms of enjoyment and relationality beyond intimacy might allow us to flourish. The possibility of repurposing intimacy towards a world more receptive to expanded ways of living. Here is their conversation.
Intimacy builds worlds, says Lauren Boulant. Their work tracks how people have come to identify life with intimacy, and how the latter came to be privatized in stories of the romantic heteronormative couple as an object of desire for unconflicted personhood. The fantasy that love and life will be transparent, reciprocal, and stable. In the book Cruel Optimism, 2011, Berlant discusses how remaining attached to such a fantasy becomes an obstacle to flourishing in times when crisis becomes ordinary. Their method is both critical of normativity without fully rejecting it, and understanding of people's aspirations to it without fully indulging them. But as a theorist, Berlant is also invested in repurposing intimacy and making it involve all relations that are treated as a matter of course. One of the great invitations of their work, then, is to ask its readers what else they need to flourish besides dominant fantasies of the good life. What other spaces of enjoyment and relationality can we imagine, and how can we build on those attachments and patterns in order to create a world of curiosity and play that is more meaningful than the one we are living in now? This question also has political resonance. Which lives count as a good life? In our conversation, the private and public intersect because, as Berlant's work convincingly demonstrates, in lived experience there is no way of telling them apart. In your work, you expand the concept of intimacy, pointing our attention to other sorts of attachments.
My contribution to the book I titled Intimacy, 2000, was, let's not talk about public and private anymore. Let's talk about intimacy, which transects public and private. The intimate is everywhere. You bring it everywhere and it circulates everywhere. It registers as intensities of attachment and recognition, inferred and explicit, that pass across people, groups, and movements. At the start, I wanted to locate myself in a feminist and Frankfurt school tradition of thinking about the domestic and the world, that you begin in relation and in an atmosphere of responsivity. I wanted to start with that sense of being with, by reflecting on our attachments to the world, and on which count as being recognized as deserving to be in the world. The philosopher Jürgen Habermas associates this with modernity as such, but in the era of the neoliberal reorganization of privacy, property, and publicness, we are lured into thinking that what we return to at the end of the day is real, and all other things are accidents of spontaneous encounters at, for example, our workplaces, on the train, across the room, not expressions of structural discipline at all. The other part of that intervention was to think about queerness. What excited me was that in order to look forward to life and have some access to objects to long for and that allow for pleasure, forms of life have to be built through repetition and return. And queers have no choice but to do it. They have to have neighbourhoods and other forms of mediated locales, places to go to and ars erotica, as well as developing unsaids around safety and desire that are so intense they become explicit. Queer practices bring the intimate into circulation to create spaces of intimacy and registers, including, but not identical to, the register of freedom.
The COVID-19 pandemic has made explicit how the social imagination is still built around the nuclear family and work. For instance, there seems to be little discussion on other forms of intimacy and relationality, friends, community, life, etc. When this is talked about, it is in terms of management. The government offers some expectations to the youth.
You are right that the neoliberal state matters, but this insistence on the private and the personal is also true of the social welfare state, which organised the justification for state support in terms of the family and work, e.g. tiny and specific infrastructures. One of the terrible things about neoliberal state policy is its redistribution of responsibility, meaning that in a sense no one has it. No one knows where it is because it's circulating, often outsourced. We need to recognise that the distribution of responsibility is partly the story of the state, capital and the other institutions. But we also need to recognise its exploitation of normative life genres. Many people think having a life means having familial or long-term love that work supports while providing opportunities for the intimacies that come from regular encounters at work, after work and so on. I tend to use phrases like the problem of the reproduction of life to leave open for analysis the dynamics among labour, intimacy, fantasy and ideology. In Cruel Optimism, there's a chapter on the film Rosetta by the Dardenne brothers. All the title character wants is to be exploited. and she throws herself into work and relationships outside the family because then she would feel that she has a world. The cost of her self-flinging doesn't matter to her so much. From the first shots, she's relentless. She has an ulcer, though. Her desperation to be in official economies and spontaneous attachments is eating her alive. In her book Intercourse, Andrea Dworkin said that sex is a loyalty oath to being in the world, and I think that's probably truer about sex than work. People desire to throw themselves at someone so they can start a plot named life.
Another register is that of compassion, the media commenting that it is hard for singles in times of social distancing.
A lot of work has been done by sociologists such as Sasha Rosneil and the literary critic Michael Cobb on the problem of securing worlds for the single and also for the old. People who are not in a unit that is associated with having a life. They are on their own or seen as burdens. There's a reason that the single and queer people are associated with each other. Their lives are often not centrally organized by the couple form, and so they're not in the social imaginary of society as a repro imaginary. The ethics of an economic ideology are revealed in what it does with and for the people who aren't in production, babies, the sick, and old people. This raises the question of being deserving. That is a political struggle. COVID has raised to the level of daily concern the debate about which lives should be protected and extended on some axis of judgment. Often the essential workers are deemed expendable ones if they are not unionized. And within this, all kinds of class and racial antagonisms are being played out. What does it mean to say that someone has to earn their life?
Against the privatization of intimacy, your work is dedicated to rethinking intimacy as a way of world making. How can we strengthen and multiply this building now that this world is ending? In other words, how can we make the leap to create another world and not to repeat this one?
One thing I've learned from reading work on the Anthropocene and its variations is that it is a comforting fantasy to think that the world is ending. The fantasy of an end gives you a finitude and formal satisfaction, whereas the fact of the matter is that we're living in the ending and don't know where we are in that ending. In Stephen Jay Gould's cancer memoir, he says that every statistic has a long, thin tail at the beginning for those who don't survive very long, a big hump in the middle for people who survive for an average amount of time, and then a long tail at the front, which is the time you live beyond the prognosis, and you never know where you are in the tail. That sensitivity to how much living is with the pressure of ending struck me as an important point. Another thing is that I'm very influenced by the anarchist attention to building worlds from where we live and where intimacy is a mode, resource, and effect of how worlds are built. I have thought about this too in relation to love. Is the only value of an enduring attachment the way a leap of faith and desire works out? In love, you hope to open yourself up to change without trauma, even though your way of being will be disturbed by the pressures of the ongoing attachment. Overall, rather than leaping to judgments about intimacies and ranking them, I'm more interested in moving through modes of social attachment, in squatting there, in sitting down where other people want to get out and judge effects.
Is this something you are considering in your ongoing work?
Yes. My new book, On the Inconvenience of Other People, argues that critics have an obligation to produce concepts as transformational infrastructures so that you can see how to get from here to there. In this book, I also work with Foucault's concept of the heterotopia. The heterotopian makes these folds of life like a really good conversation you have with somebody, or you start to take walks every day, or you decide to do a different thing in your classroom. All these things become heterotopic potentialities because they create a fold of a different kind of life right next to the one you're already living. And one of the hardest things to recognize, and this is about ambivalence, is that you are creating new spaces from within the old spaces without replacing them. This is the problem of both and. You don't stop being in the world, but you also make other possibilities. And eventually those folds can become the reference if you allow them to take on some weight, or if you can gather the resources with other people to make them. This is also how I would answer your previous question of not repeating the world, but creating another one. Unlearning attachments is just incredibly slow and difficult, and you cannot just will it. I mean, you can will your desire for it and you can make yourself ready, but the undoing of your viscera takes forever even, as you get so embarrassed by your own mind and ideation. It's like, I'm not thinking that, it is thinking itself, and I have to own that because it's in me, but it's not real. It's not what I identify with or want to build. What do I do with all that stuff? I'm interested in a non-reproductive theory of the social, but I recognize that the transitional moments are there forever.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Many contemporary thinkers focus on the work of care and community as a means to live through what you call the crisis ordinary. The sense that ordinary is in crisis and that crisis has become ordinary. A crucial question in those discussions is, how can we scale the relationality up from the local to another? Say, national, urban, or global scale.
To me, the concept of scaling up is not so interesting, because it overpresumes the neutrality of the rescaled object and often enforces a normative implication that the bigger the scale of a project is, the more important it is. My work is written against any presumption like that because the effects of action take place in many locales, the nation, the city, the neighbourhood, your sense of the global, etc. I am interested in scale as a more lateral relation than a horizontal one. The question of political organising then becomes, where do you want to focus your build? Are you somebody who gives food out? Do you give your money to an NGO or do you respond to Excel sheets, such as the ones we have in my neighbourhood, where people can put down their needs? What about the circulation and communication of a counter-organisation in the world? Who hears it? Who is affected by it? Do you have compelling arguments for people to interrupt their life? Because the question of scale is also about risk. Who is willing to risk the interruption of their specific life in order to have a life world they would welcome? In short, what are you doing with the time you don't have to make something else happen? These are the questions of scale, rather than how you can take the feeling you have and make a world for it.
A crucial concept in your work is effect, a concept to assess how one is moved by the world and how one feels to belong to the world, something in which you always understand in a historical and cultural manner. Could you tell us how you came to create and conceptualize effects like cruel optimism?
Yes, it is strange to have become in the business of refunctioning and creating affects, but I'm so happy it was useful. I think cruel optimism had a really visceral clarity for people because you can't live without attachment as potential and constrained. Cruel optimism does not argue that all attachments are bad or impair your flourishing, but some are, such as the current attachment to the good life fantasy. But that's not the only one, because cruel optimism is a quality of the relationship to your object, not a quality of the object itself. With On the Inconvenience of Other People, another work about processing ambivalence, inconvenience is the thing I want people to have the experience of. It's a concept implicating our styles of the encounter with life rather than merely what we go through every day when we're irritated by stuff. The book makes the argument that there is an inconvenience drive. People actually want to be inconvenienced by the world. They want to be jolted, excited, interested in stuff, to feel chosen and have curiosity without feeling they might lose everything. At the same time, the things we let in or are forced to let in are also threats to our sense of being and ongoingness. I hope that people get interested in this problem, perceive their inconvenience and their distribution of it to others in a richer way. I'm also thinking with people who are in biopolitically dominated or compromised populations, who both recognize their implication in the world and see how they're both necessary and inconvenient to the reproduction of power. The question is, can we use our inconvenience against the reproduction of power's ordinary harms, cuts, dings, or attritions?
What drew you to affect theory?
Part of my interest in affect is about how people get attached to concepts and the way they get attached to lovers, how people take abstractions extremely personally, and how they throw themselves into things without a plan or ideology. Sometimes it's ideological in the sense that people throw themselves into things that they have learned they should throw themselves into, but often it's inventive. And that's why you have to know about affect, because something makes you do something while not knowing why you did it. My interest was in discovering how we register affect as a kind of belated experience. That's why I also work on genre, because genres are spaces where problems of causality are also reflected on and disturbed.
One of the genres that is very attractive to people is the enrapturing music video, a genre that is rather lacking in casualty and narrativity and is foremost an affective atmosphere in which people wish to stay. I want my entire life to be this music video. It's not dissimilar to the end of a romantic film where the love interests recognize that they belong together, after which the film stops and the hardest part of building a life together is not shown. But as with the music video, that scene installs a longing for recognition to stay as an affective intensity.
That's how people live, right? When they find some happiness, they just want it to go on like that forever. That's how Freud defines pleasure, as the state you want to be in. But this affective state doesn't have to feel positive the way pleasure suggests. It could feel like affective comfort food, sometimes provided by the return of shame, or loneliness, or aestheticism, or ennui, any state where people get to coast the way they want. Media that offers ecstatic atmospherics, the music video, but also TikTok, mumblecore, or lo-fi, are very powerful because they fold an alternative world of fantasy and fascination from where people live. José Muñoz would talk about this as a kind of utopianism. You create utopianism not because you are getting a future, but because you experience effectively a world you want to live in before there is an infrastructure for it. In the DIY and professional music video, artists usually find ways to demonstrate pleasure without making viewers feel small, modeling a freedom someone might want to imitate or be proximate to, as in fan or stan culture. I'm a little more skeptical because I wonder, does the aesthetic pastoral matter, or is it merely a ruse of alternativity? The question is how we take up a position in our pleasures and attachments.
But then working on these platforms such as Instagram, TikTok, requires an enormous amount of labour that goes unseen and which is exploited by those platforms.
People are into self-exploitation if they can make something through which other people will find them. You and I are writers, what's the difference? Most posters are not influencers. How people want to put themselves in the position to be found, that's a really complicated thing. Of course, I don't disagree that we're providing monetizable value in exchange for our circulation of interest. It would be better if there was no property relationship to art and performance and other forms of labor.
It does seem a depleting way of having to be found. You constantly need to post on these platforms again and again without any guarantee of being successful.
But what work isn't depleting? People are just putting it out there, like rap and house music in the early days too. Maybe it'll have a hook. The whole idea of a hook is so central to pop culture. And in The Female Complaint, I argued that the central message of pop culture is you are not alone. And even the gesture of making is a sign that you know you're not alone. The question is, will you be found and in the way you particularly want? I do a lot of writing exercises in my class and I tell my grad students, you write because you want to be found. But I don't mean you want to be idealized, although that's often what wanting to be found means, because if you're not idealized, you're nothing in many registers of mass society. To my friends suffering from writer's block, I always say that the thing they can't bear is that their writing is a demonstration of their ordinariness. All of their grandiosity is in their head, and then they put words on the page, and their approximateness produces dread and the sentiment of, oh, I don't know if I can live. And I've experienced it, and everybody experiences it, but I love my ordinariness. I find it comic. There is no middle ground when you have to be a star in order to be anything, and I much prefer the middle. There are lots of goofballs on TikTok who are not trying to be famous, but who are showing up to be part of the aesthetic. So we turn to the question of the intimacy or the impersonality of belonging, a genre of intimacy. On social media, there is a desire to be found, whether or not your thought is spontaneous or worked on. It's live. You want people to go there with you. That's the thing about the impasse. How do you get people in there with you to help it move somewhere? But I agree with you that it's better for life if you don't confuse the idealization drive with world building. If everyone needs some space of self-idealization, can we think of the space where they're happy to encounter themselves as distinct from being perfect or being invulnerable, And would that shift change people's relation to their action, production, aesthetics?
Could you speak about the intimacy of writing, and especially about your collaborative work with Kathleen Stewart, with whom you wrote The Hundreds, 2019? To me, the work enacts ambivalence, which, as you say, is not something negative, but rather being pulled in many directions.
Interestingly, the word ambivalence doesn't appear in that book, but ambivalence as a feature of engagement really does. I was trained in deconstruction, so the idea that X kind of being, thing, encounter, signified, or concept has many others, not just one, is really important to me. The idea that antimony hides internal connections, catheses, and dependencies too. Then I read about overdetermination in psychoanalysis, that you do not only love or hate the object of your desire, but that you and your object are in a tangle of tones, causes, and effects that vary in intensity over time. Katie and I are quite different in the face of that because she's interested in getting the gist of actual objects and the haunted atmospheres of relation, where I tend to dilate the encounter and develop multiple ways of being in it. In fact, we have influenced each other quite a bit. Collaboration is a meeting of minds that don't match. Collaboration is an amazing thing. It makes teaching possible, makes conversations like the one you and I are having possible, and it makes thinking with another person really exciting and intense. It is something you need training in and a lot of ego armor for, in the sense that you need to be able to say, well, I'm going this other direction, but I still think we're on the same page as far as the process goes. We both think the work on The Hundreds made us better writers. Because of the spareness of the concept, each piece is 100 or multiples of 100 words long, so we had to cut things down. But also, we were really committed to seeing something and to seeing that anything could become a concept if you make a space for it, where it could resonate beyond its thingness, to recognize that thingness is a resonance. That's what The Hundreds means to me as a critical project. It's a craft for extending a concept, object, scene into causalities and effects that provide twists and changes to the dimensionality. It's about being drawn into situations or dynamics and following them out to a limit.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
You've been listening to an interview by Hans de Meyer with Lauren Berlant, read by Honey Brown and Jane Wallace. This interview was published in Extra Extra magazine in 2021. We are extremely grateful to Extra Extra magazine for allowing us to reproduce this interview in audio format for this episode of Art Not Science. Just opened this evening at the Physics Room is our latest exhibition, Homing Instinct, featuring works by Ariane Kasa, Ananta Titnat, Kahurangi Ariki Smith with Bunthyun Ung and Dineke Jansen. The exhibition responds to living in a time that requires not only redress of housing inequalities, but more spacious conceptions of housing, shelter and belonging. The Physics Room is located at 301 Montreal Street, Christchurch, and is open Tuesday to Friday, 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. and 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. on weekends. The exhibition will be on until the 1st of September. Thank you for listening and tune in on August the 16th at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art, Not Science, hosted by the Physics Room.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.